Hello, and welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. Uterine fibroids are the most common non-cancerous tumor in women of childbearing age. In fact, research shows that up to 80% of women will develop fibroids by the age of 50. Fibroids can have a profound impact on a woman's life, affecting everything from her menstrual cycle to fertility and even her daily quality of life. What causes fibroids? How can they be effectively managed or treated? And why do fibroids affect some women more severely than others? Back with us again is Dr. Matthew Lindemann, a board-certified obstetrician and gynecologist specializing in minimally invasive surgery, caring for patients in Anchorage for over 20 years. He is the founder of Borealis Life, an acronym that thoughtfully represents the Laparoscopic Institute for Fibroids and Endometriosis. Here he offers a multidisciplinary approach to the treatment of endometriosis, uterine fibroids, and pelvic pain. Dr. Lindemann, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Jillian. Great to be back.
Thank you. In today's pre-recorded episode, we are privileged to welcome back Dr. Lindemann, renowned for his valuable insights on endometriosis and self-advocacy, which he previously shared with us in a live program. While we won't be taking calls today, we eagerly invite your feedback or suggestions via email at line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Lindemann joins us again to shift our focus towards discussing the diagnosis and management of uterine fibroids. Dr. Lindemann, before we get into the specifics of fibroids, can you please share with our listeners a bit about your professional background and what inspired you to specialize in gynecology and further specialize in the treatment of fibroids?
Yeah. My dad was an OBGYN, so that was part of it, though he did discourage me from going into it because of the being up in the middle of the night kind of things.
Babies come at all times.
Exactly. But was an inspiration for me to go into medicine for sure. And I had the vision of being a primary doctor and getting to know my patients and the continuity of care. So that's what my vision was going into medicine. And then my first rotation as a third year med student, it was in surgery. And I realized that that was just really fascinating. I really enjoyed that. I had to try to incorporate that. And OBGYN is really the only field where you can do primary care, get to know your patients, see them over a long period of time, like different stages in their life, and also get to have surgery as being a key component of your practice. So that's where the inspiration came from for me.
And then you further specialized in minimally invasive surgery. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, my training in residency in Milwaukee, we had really good training in laparoscopy, minimally invasive gynecology. So when I came to Anchorage, that was definitely a part of my repertoire, and started treating more patients with endometriosis because that's a big component of minimally invasive gynecology is treating endometriosis and uterine fibroids as well. So it just kind of naturally developed as a big part of my career. Mm-hmm. And then more recently, I've decided to kind of dedicate my career mainly to that. I still do a little bit of obstetrics because people that I've delivered their babies before kind of...
They want you back?
Exactly. So I do a little bit of obstetrics, but really my practice is geared more towards helping women with pelvic pain, endometriosis, uterine fibroids, and things that are kind of amenable to minimally invasive gynecology.
I guess we'll get into the treatments more mm-hmm. specifically later.
Yeah.
But when you're talking about minimally invasive surgery, I think we've come a long way in the treatment of fibroids because those used to be very major open surgeries at all times. And now you're saying that you could treat this in a minimally invasive same day.
Yeah, exactly.
In and out.
Without
surgery.
Having uterohysterectomy,
yes.
Right?
Right.
Yeah.
So that's pretty amazing.
Yeah. I'm really excited about the various treatment modalities that are available today for uterine fibroids. There's a multitude of minimally invasive kinds of surgeries and procedures that can be done, as well as the medications that are now approved to be used to treat the bleeding and treat the pain and the pressure symptoms of fibroids. So I think it's a really an exciting time to be involved with treating fibroids. And there's everything so new that we're trying to figure out how these different modalities can work together and kind of develop algorithms of how we approach and how do we use these different tools, depending on each person's individual, you know, situation. So it's really exciting.
So the field of OBGYN is quite unique and diverse in that you can deliver babies, you can do surgery, you can do primary care, education, there's hormone management. But the very thing that makes it unique may make it very difficult to treat people with complex issues. So I'm thinking, you know, even at your general OBGYN office, where they have a lot of knowledge in treating many things, some of these patients with these chronic conditions probably need a little more hand-holding, I guess, and listening, and that's where you could step in because you have more time.
Yeah, exactly. I think that it's a bandwidth issue, too. I mean, you can only, there's only so much energy and things that you can kind of really stay up on the most current information. Right. So sometimes they're just good to have lanes, you know, people that are good at and concentrating, focusing on one thing, and other people that can focus on something else. That's not to say that general OBGYNs can't treat fibroids. I'm not saying that at all. But it is, I think, helpful to have, you know, people in Anchorage that kind of dedicate themselves to really staying up on the most current things and kind of advancing their skills to be able to offer the most, you know, the most advanced comprehensive approach.
And they're doing that now at large practices out of state. They have they have pathways.
Right.
And so your pathway may be office management. Another person's pathway is surgery. Another person's is hospital care of obstetric patients.
Correct.
So I think we're seeing movement in that direction of specializing more.
Yes.
Because you're right, it's very difficult to stay up on latest research and the advances in surgical management for everything.
Yeah. No, you can't really be an expert in everything.
Well, let's get into fibroids. Can you give us a quick tutorial about uterine fibroids? What are they? Where are they? What do they do?
Right. It is a benign tumor originating from the muscle of the uterus. They're super common. Probably up to 80% of women, people with uteruses, have fibroids. Not all of them are symptomatic, but a large number of them are. So it's almost always benign. There are cases where there are things that are called sarcomas that can look like fibroids. Usually they'll look a little different, behave differently. So if you have a fibroid, something that presumed fibroid that's growing really quickly or is looking kind of degenerated on them in the middle or looks kind of unique or abnormal on the imaging, that would be a little more suspicious. But it's very low chance. It's almost always benign condition that can cause all kinds of different symptoms.
Right. So I think that's a scary thing that you bring up is that sarcoma. So are we saying that that is just different and it just can behave or look like a fibroid, but it is not the fibroid that becomes the
correct
sarcoma?
Yeah, I think
the cancer.
So it's not like fibroids can turn. Fibroids don't turn into sarcomas. There are sarcomas, but they originate. The original cell would be a sarcoma. So I don't want people to think, you know, that have been diagnosed with fibroids absolutely cannot.
They're not turning into cancer.
Exactly.
Okay, good to.
Good point.
Good to mention.
Right.
So tell us about where fibroids are in the uterus specifically.
Yeah, it's they really can cause a variety of different symptoms kind of based on where they are in the uterus. I mean, they can be other places too. They can be, I mean, I think you mentioned on the previous program that you had a situation in residency where someone had a fibroid outside of the...
Yes. There was a vena cava fibroid too. I don't think I mentioned that one, but that was another...
Yeah. Not super
First
common.
Time ever seeing that.
Not super common, but
not easy to treat.
No, scary for sure. I'm sure. Yeah. So we kind of identify fibroids as being a kind of relation to where they are to the lining of the uterus. So there's a classification of fibroids called the FIGO. It's a French name for the Federal OBGYN.
Institute for Gynecology.
Yeah. Federation. It's a French way of saying it. It's a worldwide governing body for OBGYN. So they have a lot of different staging for a lot of different things, but they have not staging for fibroids in terms of cancer because it's not cancer.
Right.
But in terms of the location of them. So the closer they are to the lining of the uterus, they're called submucosal. And then if it's in the body, the muscle of the uterus, then it's intramural. And then if it's towards the outside of the uterus, they're called subserosal. And the ones towards the lining tend to cause more trouble, especially in terms of bleeding. So it's really important when we're talking to patients that have fibroids and different symptoms that they have, that we know where their fibroids are located, and then we can tailor a treatment plan that's specific to that for them.
Well, tell us about some of those symptoms. You said the ones inside the lining yep. are most commonly to cause bleeding.
Correct.
And what about those intramural ones? And do you find it depends on size? I see
yeah.
Smaller size may not do much, but something a little longer, larger, or yep. something that could be in the muscle and also in the lining.
Right, right. Because it's not just in the muscle or in the lining. They can be mainly in the muscle and then encroach on the lining. Mm-hmm. I think the closer they are to the lining, the more likely that they'll cause more bleeding problems at a smaller size. Any fibroid is capable of causing heavy bleeding, but the further it is to kind of going out the outside of the uterus and pushing out that way, it has to get bigger to cause the degree of bleeding. And oftentimes as they get bigger, so a subserosal fibroid that's big enough to cause abnormal bleeding is probably big enough to cause pelvic pain and also pressure. Pressure is a big component of symptomatology. You know, as you know, a lot of patients have problems with frequent urination or even urinating at night. And it sounds like a minor thing, but if you're really having to go to the bathroom every 30 minutes, it can really start to affect your quality of life. You know,
absolutely.
You imagine you want to go to Alyeska and go skiing, and you have to stop every run to go to the bathroom. It can really be something pretty significant. So just a sense of pressure is also something that people will complain of and can be pretty significant in people's lives. There can be definitely cramping with their periods. That can be pretty serious. So those are the main symptoms.
What's the largest fibroid that you've seen?
I treated one recently that was 14 centimeters. And we did a procedure for her, the Acesso procedure, and then it didn't work for that. It shrank and then it grew again. So then we ended up doing a hysterectomy, and her uterus was over 2,000 grams.
So that's pretty large. Yes.
Yeah, a normal uterus is like about 80 mm-hmm. grams, so it's like 20 times larger than the average uterus. It went definitely above her belly button.
So when you're thinking about pressure and pain,
yes.
there's a
Can
reason for that, and you know that weight is significant. So you're carrying a small pregnancy
like
around
5 pounds.
You know, and yep. this is a muscular growth. So
right.
if you're having a large muscular growth or several, some people have a lot of small fibroids,
right.
that would make it very
yes.
heavy.
Yes.
So
yeah.
I could see those pressures and then
yes.
putting that pressure on the bladder. Or have you seen
yep.
people that have bowel issues?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had a patient recently that had a fibroid that was kind of stuck between the uterus and her rectum and just putting a lot of pressure. And she's definitely much more able to have normal bowel movements now than she's having before. Can also cause trouble with infertility, preterm birth, IUGR, intrauterine growth restriction. So fibroids also have unique effects on, you know, if we're getting into the fertility realm, can definitely have a lot of effects on that side as well.
Right, that's right. And positioning of the baby.
Yep, malposition,
yes.
breech presentations,
yes.
increased risk of C-section. Even can be obstructive if it's low enough in the uterus into the pelvis that it could cause obstruction of labor.
And then you're thinking about, let's get into what causes fibroids, because then we can talk about in pregnancy the issue with fibroid growth and why that occurs.
Right.
So tell us about the cause of fibroids. Is there a true cause?
Yeah, it's one of these like multi-modality kind of things. There's a huge genetic component and even a racial component. African-American people are much more likely to have fibroids and much more likely to have larger fibroids. Even with, you know, separate from a race issue, there's a genetic component so that people whose parents or whose moms have fibroids are more likely to themselves to develop uterine fibroids. We know that it's related to estrogen. So things that would cause people to have increased estrogen, it's been linked to uterine fibroids. Dietary things, lifestyle things can also have been linked, like high diet, high in sugar, red meat, alcohol. Those are low in fruits and vegetables. Those all would be risk factors. Obesity is a risk factor for developing uterine fibroids. Soy can be a risk factor. So there's a lot of things that play a role. There's some concern, though, maybe some of the steroids that we're using, you know, in our meat products and milk, that maybe that could be contributing. I don't know if that's been to be true or not true, but there's definitely a concern that could be a component of that. Like, why does eating red meat cause you to have increased fibroids? Is it because of the steroids that are in the meat that we're consuming?
I agree with that. And I was thinking about that too, having that same question about red meat. But I know that, you know, I look into using organic products from reputable sources because of that, and the fact that they're using steroids and, you know, antibiotics, right? You know, they're using steroids sometimes to help animals grow and overproduce so that they can make meat. But now you see in a lot of our meat products and packaged in the store that they'll say this is free of steroids.
Right.
And then you're thinking about, you know, the problem with steroids or the problem with soy. Let's say it increases your estrogen levels.
Yes,
and there's a lot of talk about foods and things that disrupt our hormones.
Right.
And so any disruption, something's, it's a delicate balance that we need. So anything that messes with that, I see a problem with.
Exactly.
So, and with estrogen, you know, that delicate balance is messed up with pregnancy, right?
Yes. Interestingly, when you're pregnant, you have a higher progesterone estrogen ratio. Mm-hmm. So being pregnant frequently, like the more pregnancies, the longer you've spent pregnant in your life will decrease the risk of fibroids. So that's kind of interesting. Also, long-term use of oral contraceptives or...
Yes, we had talked before about not saying birth control anymore and just saying hormonal medications.
Right, meant for contraception.
Yes, yes. But
in some ways, in some fashions, yes, can decrease the risk of fibroids. Though I did do some reading that early use of these medications that have estrogen, say in people that are, you know, middle teenage years, might potentially increase the risk of fibroids, that there's some kind of a link there. Not that everybody who's 16 and is on birth control is going to develop fibroids. I don't mean to say that, but that there could be a little bit of a risk factor there. One really cool thing that I found in my research recently is that vitamin D levels in Southern Alaska, we don't get much vitamin D, right? Because it's converted into active vitamin D in our skin by sunlight. And we just don't, you know, as we know, we don't have a lot of sunlight for a big part of the year. So Alaskans are just always low on vitamin D. If you see someone even with low normal vitamin D, you're kind of like, wow, you must be on like very high supplements to get to low normal.
Yes.
And there's a pretty definitive link between low vitamin D and development of fibroids. And the treatment of that can actually, there's really multiple good studies that show that by being on high dose vitamin D and something called EGCG, which is a green tea extract, can actually decrease the size of uterine fibroids. So that was really exciting.
Okay.
Yeah.
What is it called again?
EGCG.
Okay.
There's a, I was trying to remember the long name for it, but I can get you the reference too.
Yes, I think we should share that. That's interesting.
Yeah, exactly.
So are these some the new advances and research in the field?
Exactly.
I was curious because you did mention there could be a genetic component, but also are we seeing a connection between endometriosis and fibroids? Are we seeing that there's, if you have fibroids, can we assume that you may also have endometriosis?
I don't know if it's that strong of a link that you would automatically assume. I think that there is an overlap for sure. And there's, it makes sense because they're both kind of linked to estrogen. Mm. So if you have reasons to have too much estrogen, then that is going to potentially drive fibroids to develop and be larger and more symptomatic. And that could also potentially drive endometriosis to be more active and cause more trouble as well. So there's a link there, but I wouldn't say like anybody with fibroids is for sure going to have endometriosis or vice versa. But it increases your risk to a certain degree.
It increases your risk of endometriosis.
If you have one, you'll have increased risk of the other.
And it works the other way around.
Sure.
And the good thing about fibroids is that the diagnosis is much more simple than it is with endometriosis, as long as you're getting to someone that can do that evaluation.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, I want to get more into treatments.
Yes.
After we come back from this first break, we'll talk more about what you're going to do to manage fibroids. You are listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. A reminder for our listeners that this is a pre-recorded show and we will not be receiving calls today. After this short break, we will continue our discussion of uterine fibroids with Dr. Matt Lindemann as Line One continues statewide. Welcome back to Line One. I'm your host, Dr. Jillianne Woodruff. As a reminder, today's episode is pre-recorded, so we won't be taking live calls. However, we are delighted to continue our conversation with our expert, Dr. Matthew Lindemann. Dr. Lindemann is a distinguished gynecologist with over 20 years of experience, and he is the founder of Borealis Life in Anchorage. He specializes in the diagnosis and management of uterine fibroids, endometriosis, and pelvic pain. Let's dive back into our insightful discussion. So, Dr. Lindemann, we are just about to get into the treatment, the management of fibroids. Can you talk to us about the surgical options that are available?
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. And it's really important, I think, that people realize that there are a lot of different options and that hysterectomy is not necessarily something that they have to be okay with, because a lot of doctors will just kind of recommend that and aren't necessarily like up to date on the most advanced other minimally invasive treatments. So, and then the treatments kind of depend a little bit how big the fibroids are and where they're located. So, there's something called myomectomy where we can actually remove the fibroid and we can do that in a minimally invasive way. Sometimes we use a robot, sometimes we don't. It's very rare that you'd have to actually make an abdominal incision to do a myomectomy in my experience. Sometimes we might have to do that, and there's advantages of that in terms of time. That would be a quicker surgery. But the recovery from a minimally invasive surgery is going to be a lot faster. So usually it's better to take a little bit more time during the surgery to accomplish it minimally invasively. It's going to be better than having a, 4 to 6 week recovery. So, there's another surgery call that, well, you can do the myomectomy laparoscopically, or if the fibroids are more submucosal towards the lining of the uterus, then we can do hysteroscopic myomectomy.
That's going in through the vagina,
the cervix, mm-hmm. into the uterus. And we can visualize a fibroid and you can remove it that way. And that involves no, incisions that way, no incisions on the skin. And a lot of times people have more than one fibroid. So you might approach certain fibroids in a certain way and other fibroids in a different way in the same surgery. So I've kind of developed this idea of not calling any given fibroid surgery a myomectomy or laparoscopic or hysteroscopic, that we just do a multiple modality treatment of uterine fibroids. And I didn't talk, there are some other treatment options, one called Acessa that I've learned to do more recently that is using an energy called radiofrequency. It's not radiation. I had a patient consent to do this, have this procedure. And then she came back to me for the pre-op visit. And she said, so this radiation that you're going to give me, I'm like, oh my gosh, you thought that was going to be radiation. I'm sorry. Like, that would be kind of a scary thing to hear. So it's not radiation. It's like radio frequency. It's just a certain energy we use to heat up those cells to get really hot, and then it actually breaks down the cells. So we can do that minimally invasively. It's actually an ultrasound that we place laparoscopically into the abdomen, and we have two TVs. So there's one TV is looking at the ultrasound view, and the other TV is looking at the laparoscopic, so you can see with the camera the uterus
inside
and the fibroids.
Abdomen.
Yep, exactly. And then we place a needle into the fibroid, and we can see the ultrasound can see where that needle is. So you can see exactly what you're treating, and you can radioablate the fibroids. And it's not perfect. It's definitely, it shrinks the fibroids about 50%. And the key to the Acessa is that there's still going to be a mass there, but it's not going to act like a fibroid. It's not alive. There'll always be something there, like the debris from the cells that were broken down, but it won't have the same kind of pressure or bleeding issues, those symptoms are significantly improved. And one main advantage of the Acesso, there's a couple main advantages. One is that their return to normal functioning is really like 3 to 5 days. Like people can go back to work really,
amazing.
Really. I know. The other advantage too is that with that ultrasound that we placed for the Acesso, we can see fibroids that you might not be able to see in other ways of doing ultrasounds, either abdominal ultrasounds or vaginal ultrasounds. We can, because that probe is closer to the uterus, so we can see things better. So it kind of makes sense to me that if we're doing a myomectomy, that we should remove the fibroids that we are planned to remove, but then also place the Acesso ultrasound probe so we can just look for other ones and treat them when they're smaller. And that would, you know, extend the amount of time that people will be fibroid free.
And the recovery from this seems to be quicker than if you had even done a robotic myomectomy and just removed the entire mass.
Exactly. So there's pros and cons. The myomectomy is going to be more definitive in terms of removing the fibroids that you have, but maybe not as definitive in finding smaller fibroids.
Right.
So I think you don't have to have one or the other. I think all these things can work in conjunction. It's not like they're competing with each other, but can be used in conjunction with each other in a symbiotic kind of fashion.
Is there a role, I don't know if there is at this point, but in the future, with using that ultrasound probe mm-hmm. with a robotic myomectomy?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I don't know if we would get the probe would be attached to a robot arm. Maybe eventually. That's a good, intriguing. Yeah.
So you don't miss them.
Right, exactly.
But the fact is, it could grow if you leave something behind.
Exactly. But at least we could have, our surgical assistant could be using the probe at the bedside if we can't control it with the robot. But I'm sure there's a way we could control it with the robot. I'll have to talk to the Hologic and the Da Vinci
talk
Intuitive
about the development
and see if we can come together.
Ideas.
Yes, exactly. That would be fantastic. There are other treatment modalities too that I wanted to mention that gynecologists don't really use, but the interventional radiologists do something called uterine fibroid embolization, which can be very helpful. My impression is it's better to be used in situations where there's one or two large fibroids, not a whole slew of fibroids. And the way they do that, they gain access to the vascular space through your femoral artery in the groin, and then they shoot dye and do fluoroscopy so they can get this catheter up to the main blood supply to the fibroid, and then they inject some beads or pellets that blocks off the blood supply to the fibroid, and that's can be very effective in decreasing the size of the fibroids. There tends to be quite a bit of pain afterwards. One advantage of the Acesso is that the fibroid is dying while they're asleep.
Yes.
And when they wake up, the tissue's already been destroyed so that they don't have as much pain, where during the embolization, people are awake so that necrotic process is happening when people are awake. So that tends to be one of the drawbacks of that modality. There's also one where they do MRI-guided high-intensity ultrasound. But my studying of that is, and that's done by the radiologists in the radiology department, but it's, you know, maybe the radiologists who are listening would disagree, but it seems like that's not as good as the other options in general.
As the fibroid embolization or
yep.
the other surgical
the Acesso,
options.
The myomectomy, but it's just good for people to be aware of the different options that are available. I don't know if that's aware, if it's that's available in Anchorage or not. I
but
know
the fibroid embolization is.
Exactly.
The interesting thing that you brought up, that point about degeneration. So as
yes.
that fibroid dies, it does cause pain
right.
as that happens. So, and that, of course, there's, you know, medications and things that we can
yes.
help with,
yes,
with
for
that.
Sure. Right.
But even though there's pain, you are avoiding a surgery. So there could
yep.
be some people where a surgery is
yes.
not appropriate for
yep.
them and they still have options.
Yep. And I think it's important for us as providers to be aware of the different options and not really, we shouldn't really be territorial about it. If something just seems like if somebody else can better treat something with their modality, then it just works better, because then they would refer people back to you. And it's just better for the
Absolutely.
Patients if we are willing to kind of take our ego out of it and just let things settle to where the best thing is, because there's so many different options that it's just great to be able to design a treatment program specific to each, the circumstances of each patient.
Right.
Right.
Well, I know in the early, 2000s when I did my training, we were trained that a myomectomy is for those who still wanted to retain fertility.
Right.
So if you wanted to have a baby, then you can have your fibroids removed. If you didn't want to have a baby, then a hysterectomy is the answer. Have we moved away from that now with these minimally invasive surgeries?
I think we're moving in that direction. My own personal take on it is that I've counseled a lot of people about the possibility of a hysterectomy, and I realized that the uterus is not like a tonsil or an adenoid or a spleen or an appendix. There is not universally, but there tends to be a degree of identity that's associated for people with a uterus that has to do with maternity, mm-hmm. like being pregnant, and like a lot of times people will kind of identify their femininity through their uterus. Mm-hmm. There's a process people go through to be ready for the idea of having a hysterectomy. And I've come across many examples like that, but specifically my girlfriend had a hysterectomy before she was like super ready. It was before we met. And I remember like she still thinks about that. Like her two girls are older. They were like 17 and 19, and she wasn't planning on having more children. She was like 42 at the time, but she wasn't really ready to definitively be done. And her surgeon kind of forced her through that process, like fast forward, pushed her through that. And even right before the surgery, she was asking her, like, is there any way that you could save my uterus? And the doctor kind of got mad at her and gaslighted her for, like, we talked about this and you shouldn't have more children. So I think that it's really important, even if, you're 42 and you're not really having a planning more kids, if that would still be an option. We might say like, yeah, it's a harder surgery, myomectomy. There's more bleeding. There's more complication. It's less definitive. But if that's really that you feel strongly about wanting to keep your uterus, like, I think that we should do better at making sure we're counseling patients about potential risks and benefits and why one thing might be easier, have fewer complications, but not to insist on a certain thing.
Right. And you said about the hysterectomy being more definitive. So what are some of the things or issues that can come up after a myomectomy?
During the surgery, it tends to be a longer surgery. There's more blood loss. And then the longer a surgery goes, there can be other complications like DVTs, blood clots in the legs that can go to your lungs. So, and it's a challenging technically, right? Like myomectomies are a little harder to do laparoscopically than hysterectomy. So there might be some surgeons that feel a little better about taking, dealing with fibroids laparoscopically and robotically. But, and in terms of the side effects from the recovery, I think the recovery is going to be pretty similar. Maybe a little easier for a myomectomy than a hysterectomy.
But after the myomectomy, yeah, is there a risk that those fibroids
they can grow?
Return?
Right, exactly. Not the ones that we remove, but they're, someone who's has grown one or two fibroids before, they're more likely that those could grow. So that goes into your counseling. I mean, it has to be part of the counseling.
Right.
Right.
And then let's talk about hysterectomy, because I think that's another point of misunderstanding when people tell us about their total versus partial. And it means something different as the surgeon.
Yes.
When you're taking out the uterus and cervix, that's a total hysterectomy. So can you tell us about what's left behind?
Yeah, I've had that conversation a lot, because when the doctors use a term total hysterectomy, that's very different than when, patients use that word total. So to surgeons, the total hysterectomy implies taking the uterus, including the cervix, but nothing to do with the ovaries. I always say the ovaries are completely different organs. They develop completely differently. It's different types of tissues. They're connected to each other, but they form completely independently and can be removed or left behind completely. We can take out the ovaries and leave the uterus. We can take out the uterus and leave the ovaries. We can take out one ovary and leave the other one. They're completely two different surgeries. So, it ends up being an important discussion when we're talking about hysterectomy. And it's really a separate discussion of whether you should take or leave the ovaries. It's a complicated decision, and you can't know for sure in each individual situation what's the best, but there's pros and cons, and it's just important in general that, you know, speaking to the potential, to your audience and potential patients, that just make sure that your doctor is willing to have the conversation about pros and cons and taking your opinion, you know, into account. The way I think of it is there's information the patients have that I don't have, and there's information that I have that they don't have. But it works out best. We get the most accurate, precise treatment plan if we can put all the information together and then make a plan based on all of the information, not just predominantly my knowledge or my information. That the patient's experience, concerns, and fears are really important too, in their desire, like what is most important to them. Some people are like, I never will have surgery again, so make sure that you take out anything that could possibly be taken out. And other people are like, I really would love to keep my ovaries, and if there's any way we can save them, then please help me do that. And so we have to take that into account, I think, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's really important information. And that goes back to what you were talking about in a previous program about self-advocacy.
Right, right. Exactly. If you don't feel comfortable, then don't let yourself, don't just swallow that. Make sure that you spend some time. If you really think that you need to, you know, there's more things that you need to say, and you feel like your provider is not listening, then sometimes you can advocate for yourself with that provider. You might just say that explicitly, like, I feel like you're not listening, and I'd like to have another conversation about this with some information that I'm afraid that you didn't gather. And if you don't get a good response to that, you can always try to find another doctor that would be more willing to listen.
Absolutely. Well, let's get into medical treatments. So okay. We talked about the surgical aspect, and let's talk about medications.
Yeah.
And how do you distinguish who gets surgery and who needs medications?
Oh my gosh, that's
big question for you.
That one is a big question. I think we're still working that out, because these newer birth control pill or hormonal treatments can be helpful to decrease. They're not going to make the fibroids smaller, but they can help decrease the symptomatology sometimes. People that have heavy irregular bleeding that's not because of fibroids, I think that those hormonal methods are more likely to treat that. The bleeding related to fibroids is a little bit more resistant, in my experience, to using, you know, those things that we call contraceptives.
Yes.
I don't know if that's been your experience as well.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting that you distinguish that, because when you were talking before about endometriosis, we were using hormonal medications,
yes,
like birth control, to treat the disease, basically,
yes,
or prevent it.
Yes.
And when we're talking about fibroids, it's a different thing. We're using it in a different way, hopefully to help with symptoms. And I agree. I think that it is a little bit more resistant,
yes,
to management in that way.
Yeah, I don't think, especially if you have like a 3-centimeter submucosal fibroid, I don't think
that's in the lining of the uterus,
yeah, exactly,
disrupting the bleeding.
That's not going to respond very well to those types of hormonal medications. There's other options. There's newer medications that we were talking about previously that are GnRH antagonists that affect a gland in our brain called the hypothalamus, which decreases the production ultimately of estrogen and progesterone. And those medications have been around to treat fibroids for about 2 years now. Is that about right? 2 or 3 years?
I think so.
Yeah.
And they're by mouth, so that's nice.
Orally.
You can take a pill.
Yep.
And
yeah, they're up to 2 years you can use them. And they're very good at treating the amount of bleeding, the heaviness of the bleeding. And they'll make the shrink the fibroids, make them smaller while you're taking it. You can't be on them forever. So the way that we're thinking about those medications right now is more of a bridge to something else, like a bridge to menopause or a bridge to surgery or a bridge to something else. Sometimes you can shrink the fibroids before surgery and then make something that would have needed to be an open myomectomy into a laparoscopic myomectomy. That's a consideration. But we don't really think of them right now as being the permanent solution.
You can't just stay on them
forever. No, exactly.
Because they work very well.
They do work very, very well, but it's only 2 years. And then one of the main limitations is bone mineral density. Your bones can get weakened by being on these medications too long. So sometimes I've had people go on another couple of years, but you have to be really, really careful with that kind of thing and get DEXA scans that look at the bone mineral density. But we really don't, it's not a long term. And once you stop it, then the fibroids will start to grow and come back. So
your
probably within the
come back.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, you talked about using it as a bridge to menopause.
Yeah.
So
yep.
I guess in your counseling, somebody who is closer in age to that point, mm-hmm. you can counsel them that
yeah.
this may be the best treatment for
exactly.
them to avoid this surgery.
Exactly.
But somebody who's maybe in their late 20s, this may not be the best option long term for them.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I know in Canada, they use them quite a bit as bridges because they can't have surgery right away because of the, you know, they have like longer wait lists to have surgery. So they end up, you know, waiting 6 or 9 months to have surgery. So they're able to offer something for patients to help them feel better in the meantime.
What if you do not have any symptoms from your fibroids? Because
yeah.
there are a lot of people who don't have any issue and maybe they've had imaging for another reason and they
right.
saw fibroids. Do they need to be treated?
No. We need to make sure, we still would like a good idea to follow them, maybe have a repeat either pelvic exam or a repeat ultrasound in 3 months to make sure that something's not growing extra quickly. But yeah, it's really based on symptomatology for the most part. If you're asymptomatic and we have a sense that, no, nothing's growing really fast, then you don't have to have anything done. And I think that's really important that patients know that we don't have to do anything, right? That because sometimes I think patients feel like they're being compelled to do something.
Excellent. Yeah, that's an excellent point. And then talking about the imaging,
mm-hmm.
so we're doing, you can do an ultrasound. What other imaging techniques would you use? If you suspect fibroids, is ultrasound, you know, that's typically my go-to, right?
It is, yeah. We said in the previous episode that it's definitely the best way to look at gynecologic organs in general. And there's they're really well visualized on ultrasound. MRI can also be used if there's something that's kind of more quizzical about the fibroid, if it looks different in some way. But it's pretty rare that I get MRIs for fibroids.
Okay. Well, let's get into more of this when we come back. And I also want to talk about pelvic pain as well. So let's take another short break for the stations down the line. Today's episode is pre-recorded and we will not be taking calls live. Please share questions that you would like to see addressed with us via email at line1@alaskapublic.org. We'll continue our discussion on uterine fibroids and pelvic pain with Dr. Matt Lindemann when we return. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. Just a note, today's show is a pre-recorded session, so we're unable to take your calls at this moment. We're joined once again by the esteemed Dr. Matthew Lindemann, a renowned Anchorage gynecologist and founder of Borealis Life, an acronym that stands for Laparoscopic Institute for Fibroids and Endometriosis. His expertise lies in the intricate field of uterine fibroids. Let's continue to unravel the complexities of this topic with Dr. Lindemann. Dr. Lindemann, you were talking about the medical treatments that we have and the ones that we can take by mouth.
Right.
And I would like you to go back and talk about something that we used to use
right.
quite a bit to treat fibroids, Lupron. And how is
exactly.
that injectable medication different besides just being injectable?
Right. It ends up having the same effect, but it gets there in a different way. There's a hormone called gonadotropin-releasing hormone, GnRH, that's secreted by the hypothalamus. So the way that Lupron works is it actually stimulates the production of GnRH. So people's symptoms, the estrogen gets more, people's symptoms get worse, especially with endometriosis, their pain can get worse for about 2 weeks, and then it starts to resolve, so you don't see the benefit of that shot for the first month. The newer oral medications work differently. They're an actual antagonist. So from the get-go, they'll decrease the production of the GnRH. So it's definitely easier for people to think about tolerating an oral medication that's an antagonist versus an agonist that's a long-term injection, because the side effects are going to be less, and well, at least the initial 2 weeks. And then I think probably there's fewer side effects in general from the oral medication versus the Lupron. How many people did very well in Lupron?
Lupron caused some severe menopausal side effects,
exactly.
right? Because it does eventually stop that hormone production
yep.
from your body.
Yeah.
And so they're having these these, you know, pretty severe, sometimes hot flashes
yep.
and things like that.
Yeah.
With the oral medications, are we seeing that they're also having some menopausal yeah. symptoms? So?
Yeah. And the other thing that we do with those medications is there's an add back. So in the pill for that, there's a medication that's the GnRH antagonist, but there's a tiny little bit of hormone that they add back to that. So definitely helps decrease the side effects of the medication. So they're definitely much better tolerated than the old Lupron.
Right. Now, we are also using Lupron as an injection to shrink the size of the fibroids to get ready for surgery. Are they using the oral medications in the same way?
Yeah, yeah. You can definitely do that. That's, yeah, it kind of depends in each situation, like the skill of the surgeon, what they feel comfortable, like the size of the fibroids they feel comfortable. Has to do with the degree of the patient's symptomatology, so that if they're more symptomatic, they're going to be less willing to wait a little bit longer to have the more definitive, like they will see benefit from the medication, but they'll see benefit more quickly from the surgery. So
right.
people that are having much
severe like, symptoms.
Exactly. So in my experience, most patients would rather, if they're going to have surgery, they'd rather just get to it. But there might be times when we would recommend, say, a situation where someone's severely anemic,
yes.
we can slow down their blood, you know, their bleeding, wait for 3 months, and then get them to build up their hemoglobin levels again so that when we do the surgery, which there's always going to be a little more risk of surgery, you know, of bleeding with surgery, that there would be a decrease their chances of needing a blood transfusion. So that's another reason that we would sometimes use medications.
Is there a role for them to give blood before the surgery, giving their own blood to use?
No, definitely don't recommend that because they're going to like decrease their hemoglobin levels commensurate with.
And they may already be anemic.
Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. And then there's the problems of, you know, like there would there be a contamination? Could they get an infection in that whole interchange? And I know blood banks do not like the idea of people donating blood specifically for one person. It's kind of like public health wise, it's not the best policy because then all these blood bags are reserved for different people and not available to the public to
yes.
use when those people might need it. So the blood banks are really, it's my impression at least, that they're reluctant to allow people to donate specifically for certain situations. It just is better public health, right?
That makes sense.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the surgical treatments
yeah.
because you had discussed them, but I think we left out a few things that we do to treat fibroids.
Yeah, yeah. So with the previous episode, we talked about the IUDs that have progesterone.
Oh, yes, and the
right?
medications, yes.
Yeah, okay, so yeah, there's two different things we need to talk about. One is the progesterone IUD, and that can definitely decrease its... The IUD is FDA-approved for contraception, mm-hmm. but the progesterone IUDs are also FDA-approved for treating heavy bleeding. Now, if you have a submucosal fibroid that's pushing into the lining of the uterus, it's a little bit contraindicated because it could possibly cause the IUD to be dislodged or displaced. So that would have to be, you know, the usefulness of that and advisability have to be in, you know, discussion with your doctor. But there's also another procedure called uterine endometrial ablation where this would be in the operating room with anesthesia. We go through the, in the vagina, through the cervix, into the uterus, and then we burn there's ways to do it. The one way we typically do is burning. You can also use
hot
cold.
Water.
Yeah,
you could use
or
cold.
Cryo. There's
yes.
different ways to do that. Basically,
but they're all ablating.
Exactly. You're destroying kind of the basal layer of endometrium. I describe that as like the parent cells that the endometrial cells come from. Mm-hmm. You're going to go back and bury and destroy those parent cells. So then people just don't make nearly as much endometrium. Now that's approved to be used, I believe, up to 2 centimeters submucosal. I don't think there's a restriction if the fibroids are not encroaching on the lining of the uterus, then there's no restriction that way. But if they're submucosal, I believe it's only FDA approved to be used up to 2 centimeters.
So tell me about this, because this ablation, which I love for many reasons.
Yes.
But this isn't specifically treating the fibroids.
Nope.
So tell us how this is helping us.
Yeah, yeah. So the menstrual bleeding is coming from those parent endometrial cells that are producing all the lining. So if we can destroy those, we can, no matter what is causing there to be a hyperproduction of that. And one way to think of the fibroid as causing heavy bleeding, because that might be a question, right? Like, well, why do fibroids cause heavy bleeding? Mm-hmm. One way is that if they're encroaching in the lining, the submucosal fibroids, there's an increased surface area, right? So there's, you're just going to increase the amount of endometrial cells that exist in the uterus. So then it makes sense that you would have heavier bleeding from that. Mm-hmm. Another way that fibroids can cause heavy bleeding, because you can get heavy uterine bleeding from fibroids that aren't even encroaching on the uterine cavity, right? So how does that work? And I think that the way that it best works is that the blood supply to the lining of the uterus comes from the uterine arteries that goes through the wall of the uterus into the lining. And when one way that you can decrease the amount of bleeding that you see from the uterus is by contracting the muscle of the uterus. And we see that postpartum when people can have bleeding, we give medications to help that uterus contract down, and it's pinching off the blood supply to the lining of the uterus. But when there's fibroids there, they interfere with the ability of that, of the muscle of the uterus to constrict down and cut off that blood supply.
Squeeze.
Exactly. And
as much.
The fibroids themselves have an increase. They draw, since it's a large amount of tissue, they draw bigger blood vessels and more bleeding to that area.
Interesting. Well, going back to the IUD, you were talking about the progesterone IUD. Mm-hmm. Now, there are several progesterone
yes.
IUDs, and we know that one of them is, you know, FDA approved
right.
for bleeding aside.
Yes.
Have you used any of the lower progesterone IUDs, the ones that have less
yeah.
progesterone? Is there a role for them?
We think of those that there's two that are smaller, they have less progesterone, and they're smaller size. So we mm-hmm. think of that for people that have not had kids, because the cervix opens up to allow childbirth, and that it's easier to insert things that are a little bit bigger. They're not dramatically smaller.
Yes.
Yeah. Easier to. Well, if the cervix is open, it's easier to
yes.
then insert something that's a little bit bigger. It's not dramatically bigger. It's like within a millimeter. Mm-hmm. So it's not like. But that's the way I kind of in my practice use the ones that have a little bit less progesterone and are a little bit smaller. Or if other people have other reasons to have a cervix that would be, not as open or a little harder to dilate.
If somebody has had children, would you always recommend the one that has more progesterone?
Yeah. Well, mm-hmm. part of it is I'm most familiar with it, the side mm-hmm. effects of it, how it works. And I think there's something to be said for using something that you're more familiar with. So I definitely am just more comfortable with the one.
Yeah. Are there any non-medication-based and non-surgical-based treatments for fibroids? Are they all just treatments to control symptoms?
Well, we talked about vitamin D and this mm-hmm. green tea extract, EGCG. So okay. it's definitely been shown. There was a study from the gynecologic endocrinology from January of 2022 that showed a decrease in uterine size by 17%.
From the green tea extract?
Well, the combination of the vitamin D and the
okay.
green tea extract, and they also included some B6
okay.
in that. But I think that the other two are really thought to be the heavy lifters for that benefit. So it was 17% decrease in overall fibroid size, but up to 37.3% in a single fibroid. So it's not an insignificant decrease. So I'm really excited about the possibility of using that, which is natural, and there's not really any side effects from that. I was reading something last night that I was really intrigued by. There's something called collagenase. Mm-hmm. You know, collagen is an between cells. You have this fiber that kind of connects cells and forms tissue. And there's a theory that if you inject collagenase into the fibroid, it'll break down those connections and shrink the fibroid. So yeah, so that's something that someone was just designing a study. Yeah, they were trying to get this collagenase into kind of a gel matrix so that it wouldn't just get absorbed right away, that it would sit in the fibroid for a little bit longer and have a little bit more of an effect, where if it were just in a liquid, it might seep out or get absorbed right. more quickly. So yeah, very interesting.
Very interesting
yeah.
trials and research. And
yeah.
And that's wonderful, because I know you know that you specialize in pelvic pain as well, and this
right.
is something that is a big contributor to pelvic pain. It's fibroids and, of course, endometriosis. And what are some other causes of pelvic pain?
Yeah. Well, the gynecologic organs we talked about, you can have ovarian cysts that can do that. There is a caller on the previous program that I think was describing something called Leverian torsion, where you can get your ovary can twist up its, you know, and can cut up its blood supply. There's other organs in the pelvis. There's the bowel, so you can have different, like ulcerative colitis or irritable bowel syndrome can cause chronic pelvic pain. Interstitial cystitis, which is a chronic inflammation of the bladder. You can have hip pain that feels in the pelvis. Pelvic floor spasm of the muscles of the pelvis can cause that. So there's a whole variety. So it's really important that the doctor really takes a very careful history and does a careful exam to exclude different things and make sure that you're seeing the right doctor and treating the right thing as much as we can, you know,
and
determine
that. And
it
may not be just one person.
Right. Yeah. You know, a team approach can be very, very helpful because you might have two different things.
Absolutely. And I think that self-advocacy and looking for someone that can help you, and it may not just be one person, is pretty key, right?
Very important, yeah.
Well, our thanks to our guest, Dr. Matt Lindemann, for being with us today. Thanks to our audio engineer and producer, Madeline Rose. You can find more information on this and previous programs on our website at alaskapublic.org. Let us know your thoughts or suggestions by emailing us at line1@alaskapublic.org. This has been Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. Thank you.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.